Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, small businesses and the internet. While many people, and we talk about it a lot on this show, we think of the internet as having to do with major telecommunications companies. You know, your Comcast, your Verizons, your AT&Ts, those really large companies that build a lot of pipes and do a lot of broadband deployment. But small and medium-sized businesses play a major role in the development of the internet, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So joining me to discuss this is Christian Dawson, Executive Director of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition. Is that also the I2 Coalition?
I2 Coalition is our nickname.
All right, great. Well, Christian, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, you know, bust the myth. The internet was built by basically large companies and small companies. They innovate at the edge and they provide services in the form of apps, but that's about it, right? It's just the big boys who built the internet.
That's what I've heard. But as I have traveled through this industry, as I've gotten to know it over the past two decades, I've met a whole lot of innovators, and most of them are small to medium businesses. I am now friends with a guy named Barry Shine I want to tell you about. Barry Shine is the CEO, still exists, of the very first internet service provider. Just a couple of decades ago, it's called The World. He'll tell you that he's the CEO of The World.
That's quite a title.
Yeah. And he had this idea that he was going to take internet access and he was going to sell it to people. This is in our lifetime. You know, the internet has been such an incredible innovation, but the commercial internet is a couple of decades old, and it has been predominantly driven by these small to medium businesses who had these crazy ideas that they were going to try and monetize some little piece of it.
And was he only allowed to do that after, what was it, Al Gore said that it's okay? Is that why we think of Al Gore as the inventor of the internet? Not we actually do, but there's that joke because
right. He
played a role in commercializing it, correct?
He played a role in commercializing it, right, and funding some ARPANET projects that allowed us to get to the point where we could take certain components and put them in the hands of people to use them for commercial purposes. But here's the thing. It only makes sense that this stuff has been driven by these small businesses and these small enterprising minds because this stuff is really hard. And it was so much harder when it started out. So you're looking at environments in which people didn't really understand what they were buying. It was very high touch, low margin. Sort of little businesses that you needed to be crazy
right.
to decide you wanted to start and put passion into doing, like starting the world's first ISP. I don't get it. Explain it to me.
Yeah.
You want a few bucks a month for what?
Yeah, you didn't even have really a large network of pipes at that point. They hadn't, yeah. I guess, converted the telephone copper wire network yeah. into a broadband network. So how does some guy in a garage start the internet?
Well, lots of guys in garages and girls and organizations all over the world, little businesses, have built the internet iteratively. It was never built in one place. It's built over a collection of small little pockets of ideas that layer upon each other. And together, we've built this incredible resource. And it's taken decades to get any one piece of it to an economy of scale that even has interested large businesses. For the most part, it's been absolutely the role of small business to take these little ideas and turn them into something that's interesting to their own little environment.
And you know this firsthand, you're not just talking about other people. You were involved personally in a small to medium-sized business that helped, you know, drive this innovation, and it was called Servant. And tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
So yeah, my best friend in college, he started a web hosting company back in 1995. I joined him 2 years later when I left college.
And web hosting, for listeners who might not be familiar, think of all those GoDaddy commercials you've seen with Danica Patrick, the race car driver, and it's basically a way for you to build a website and then have it be hosted somewhere so that people can access it, and it's not just a offline page on your computer, which is about as good as drawing something in paint.
You can sort of think of it like a hotel for your website.
There you go.
Yeah,
that's absolutely a good metaphor. Yeah.
And in 1997, those organizations existed. Those companies existed. But we had a crazy idea back in 1995 that basically there was you have a computer and you'd put people's websites on it, right? And you would have hundreds and maybe even thousands of websites on a single computer. And we said, we kind of think this is, you're going to end up needing a lot more power as the commercial internet grows. We're going to give people their own computer. This is before the term dedicated server even existed. That became a term later on, and well before there was something called the cloud. We basically said, well, people are going to need more power than they have right now in order to run a website, because it's not just going to be the business card experience that you have now.
And you made the gamble that this was not just going to be some fad and the whole internet, this whole internet craze was going to go away and people would go back to using pagers and, you know, stop all this nonsense. You were like, no, people are going to like this. We should build up. We should assume that more people are going to get on board and have the capacity so that everything doesn't just crash as soon as the internet becomes popular.
Well, it was a gamble, but, you know, we started working with companies, with just people, and they had these ideas, and it became really fun to empower these ideas. Like, one of my big success stories, and this was years into being the head of a web hosting company, I was speaking with the guy who ended up founding Etsy, and he was my web designer at the time.
Oh,
and he
wow.
said, I do all this knitting in my spare time, and I've got a whole bunch of people that also do similar things to me, and we've got this idea of this marketplace for crafts. Will you take a look at it? Will you help us build our first systems and get them to scale? And so I and my team got to build Etsy's first cluster, got to help them grow to a certain point, at which point now they're huge. They've got their own data center. They got their own infrastructure. But for a long time, you know, Etsy started because I worked together with a guy with a dream to help build him the systems to allow him to do that. And so, yeah, it was a gamble, but it was such a cool environment to be working with all these enterprising entrepreneurs and people with ideas to give them the resources to put them into action on the internet.
Is there an element of like the good old days in what you're talking about now? I mean, when you say it was such a cool environment, it sounds kind of past tense, and that there it was maybe different back then with all these small businesses doing hosting. And has there been more consolidation? Is it less cool now? I mean, is this kind of a nostalgic thing to talk about?
So that's actually a tricky question, because for some people it absolutely is, especially the people that have not really differentiated their services, that are still trying to offer similar services to what you get at a AWS or Microsoft. The big guys eventually found this market and they realized that they could approach it with economies of scale.
Right.
And there are organizations that are not providing value-added services that are basically not surviving the change that the market has brought. The thing is that the kind of thing I'm talking about, working with an enterprising entrepreneur to figure out how to achieve their dreams, that part of the market is thriving right now, because there's more innovation than ever. So there are people that'll tell you that it was the good old days back when they could basically wave a magic wand and get as many new companies as they want, because there wasn't that much competition. Now there's tremendous competition, and there are mass market products that will undercut you on price if price is your driving factor.
Right. So while I'm sure consumers have benefited largely from the competition and the proliferation, it's, of course, there are some smaller players that are going to get squeezed out. I guess that's how it happens in every area of industry. But so we often talk about in the United States that, you know, it's more difficult to start a business than we'd like. You could even see regulation, you know, people having a backlash to regulation and some of what happened in the Brexit vote. Like, there's just this sense that a small business, an entrepreneur, just a guy who wants to start a business has to go through so much BS to get it off the ground. So what were some of the key factors that allowed hosting in your case and in others in the 90s and in the early 2000s before, I guess, the big players got involved? These companies without lawyers, you know, without regulatory compliance divisions, how did they just take off and just do stuff without, you know, going to kiss the ring of the mayor or the city council? All the type of things we see today, where even big companies have to fight through regulators to get where they need to be. What made this environment possible?
So really, during the Clinton administration, there was this moment where we took a look at the internet, and it wasn't a big commercial driver at the time, but legislators did take a look at it and said, we don't really understand this. We don't really understand what it's going to bear, but let's not kill it in its infancy. And they made certain decisions that have really, that created an environment in which it became possible for somebody to start one of these companies in their basement or dorm room, mostly focused on intermediary liability. One of them is in the...
So are we getting at Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, where, and we've talked about this on the show before, where, you know, people take for granted that websites like Google and Facebook or YouTube don't necessarily always get sued when someone does something on their platform. It is the individual who is responsible for posting a copyright violation or violating some law through their use of the internet. It is not the platform that is held responsible. And that was a conscious decision made by Congress in 1996. And it's hard to overestimate how important that was, because you could imagine that a lot of these small companies that you were working with, if they were just getting sued into oblivion because of every little thing that a user did that was wrong. Mm-hmm. And you could imagine on Etsy that being a problem where people are patenting their work and mm-hmm. things like that, those websites could get shut down. So that kind of hands off the net approach, at least for intermediary liability, that was a conscious decision made by Congress and by the Clinton administration, Republicans and Democrats, basically saying, we don't understand this. So in what position do we have to be saying we are going to micromanage this thing that we don't even understand?
That was actually one of the two points that I was going to bring up. The first was centered around the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and specifically, though it's not perfect, around the safe harbor provisions within the DMCA. And I was trying to make sure that I explained safe harbor in a way that wasn't confusing, because there's another safe harbor now that's heavily in the news.
Yeah, so we're not talking about the safe harbor where data flows across the Atlantic between the U.S. and the EU. We are talking about safe harbor as it relates to copyright, and just explain briefly what the DMCA did, and that's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and why it's so important.
So it created a framework for notification and takedown. It made it so that organizations could register an agent, and then you basically had a procedure by which if there was copyrighted work that was on your network, your registered agent would be issued a official notice, and they would have to process that, and there are a few different ways to process it. But it made it so that you didn't have direct liability until you were put on notice.
Right. So basically the idea is that, and every listener, I'm sure, has gone to a YouTube video somewhere and it said this video was taken down. For a brief moment, that video was live. And basically this law allows YouTube to be notified and then take it down, rather than saying YouTube has to have an army of people just scraping every single nook and cranny of the site to make sure that every single video is not a copyright violation. This basically allows users and, you know, crowdsourcing of this type of thing. So someone notifies YouTube, you report, you flag a video, and then they take it down. And that allows YouTube to, you know, comply with the law without having a huge compliance cost and without being sued. And that's enormously important, especially, you know, we talk about YouTube. YouTube might be in the best position of any company to actually handle this kind of crap. But mm-hmm. if you talk about a small company, a tiny business, like what we're talking about on the show today, one lawsuit could put them out.
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
And now we're in this situation where as we are looking to address legislative issues, there often come people that say, well, YouTube, they can figure out some way to wave a magic wand and get these problems taken care of. Why can't YouTube be doing more?
Right.
But when we are taking a look at legislation, I always put it through the frame of my small business.
Right.
And try to figure out what my small business would be able to tolerate. And it's not what YouTube could tolerate.
No, there's a huge difference in resources.
Yeah.
And that's a generally a good guiding principle, probably, when you're talking about regulating the internet. Think about, sure, maybe big businesses are opposed to this regulation, so that must mean it's good for consumers. But wait, are the small businesses also opposed to this? And would the effect of the regulation actually just make the bigger businesses even more entrenched and protect their incumbency because they're in a better position to comply than a smaller business?
I started getting into policy specifically because I saw that people weren't paying attention to the smaller businesses. And I felt as though it was because they simply didn't understand that we were there. Right. There are 35,000 to 60,000 internet infrastructure companies out there, and most of them are small to medium businesses. But when people think of the internet, they think that it's something that AT&T and the telcos built, that you know, Facebook, Microsoft, Twitter, Google, a few of them use, and they're the people that you need to pass legislation by to make sure that they can comply.
Right.
The thing is that you end up having some sort of a new notice and takedown procedure that utilizes some sort of AI that can be implemented by Google and Microsoft, and the deleterious effects of that are that you reset the bar for the entire cloud such that you can no longer build a cloud company without a tremendous VC backing. With you can't just do it in your basement, dorm room, or the middle of nowhere. And when that happens, I firmly believe that innovation dies on the internet.
Now, you brought up legislation. There's a lot going on in tech policy. It's why I've enjoyed having this job for the past couple of years. It never gets old because there's always something going on. What are some of the major debates in Congress that we're having right now about tech policy that you see as having a major impact on small businesses, whether they go the right way or the wrong way? And are there certain policies that you'd like to see passed? You know, let's say you had a magic wand and you can just sign things like the president and pass bills. What would be, we have two conventions coming up. The parties are looking at how to handle this area, and tech is often an afterthought behind things like guns and ISIS and things like that. But what do you think about these debates that are going on in Congress? And, start with encryption, start with regulation, sure. Whatever you want to.
Encryption is a big one because that's one where I'm not often hearing the small business perspective. Again, it came into the public consciousness when we started talking about Apple.
Right. And Apple versus FBI, that is what basically made encryption a household issue.
Right. And the whole focus of the conversation from the FBI perspective and from many of the people in the media that I heard defending their position was Apple has got brilliant people on their end. They can figure it out somehow.
Yeah, it'll cost them $1 million for, a company that's got a market cap of, hundreds of billions of dollars. Sure, whatever. That costs them nothing. Maybe it takes a team of 20 people 2 weeks, and they're a good citizen, and they helped foil terrorism, and good for them, right?
Right. Anytime you regulate something, you've got to see how it scales down, And that's so far removed from the idea that you're going to create some sort of a policy and make sure that it scales down. They're wizards. They'll figure it out. They're really smart guys, and they got tons and tons of money. So we'll make them do it, and then we'll make everybody else do it. Well, then only the people that have, wizards with tons and tons of money can compete now. And you've created an era of incumbency based on your regulation.
Yeah, and then, we've talked about backdoors on the show before. We've talked about data retention mandates. There are all sorts of proposals that have been geared toward, helping law enforcement overcome the quote-unquote problem of encryption. Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking about a backdoor, that just defeats encryption, makes it pointless for at least end-to-end encryption. Then you talk about data retention. I mean, it costs money to store data. There's a reason that, telephone companies delete their data after a certain amount of time, because they say, snooze, you lose. If you wanted this, you should have come to us earlier, basically to the cops. It costs money. And unless the government is going to go to every single small business in America and subsidize their data retention mandate, that's a unfunded mandate. And of course, when they probably debate that issue, they think about it in the context of, well, what could AT&T handle or what could Verizon handle?
Right.
Has anyone ever asked how many small businesses would just be completely destroyed immediately if you passed the data retention mandate, if you passed a backdoor mandate?
These are the conversations that I have gotten into tech policy to have, and that's what we attempt to focus on within the Internet Infrastructure Coalition, or I2 Coalition. And the fact of the matter is that every single time we approach a situation like this, be it copyright, be it government access to data, I'm very empathetic about the ultimate goals that people bring into trying to solve their problem.
Yeah, stopping terrorism, stopping child pornography. Absolutely. It's very rarely something that we don't want to help them with. And that's the challenge.
Right. But the ramifications of solving the problems on the backs of our industry by trying to accomplish things in ways that don't scale down is, A, you're not going to be very effective at ultimately at fixing your problem, because way more of the internet is driven by these small to medium businesses than you think. And B, you're going to kill what's magical about the internet in the process of trying to solve your problems.
Now, you brought up the conscious decision by the Clinton administration and Congress in 1996 to keep their hands off the internet. We're now 20 years after that, and the commercial internet is still in its baby stage. But I would argue, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, that we are now moving away from that vision under this administration in particular, and under at least one of the FCCs under George Bush's administration. There is now an attitude that, okay, we know what this looks like, we get it, and we can now manage it technocratically the way that we manage other industries. And if we pull certain policy levers, we'll get the best outcomes. And a lot of the refrains I hear from folks we disagree with on telecom regulation is that small businesses will be the beneficiaries of the FCC regulating net neutrality, of the FCC regulating broadband privacy, of the FCC regulating how cable boxes work. So now, you know, we used to have a thing where let's keep our hands off, whether it's a big company or a small company. Now we keep hearing about activism and populism, where really what we need to do is constrain the big guys and help the little guys. Do you see this FCC and what it's been doing as beneficial to companies like yours and to small businesses?
So I'm actually going to take a partial pass on this question, just a partial pass. And that's only because I need to maintain the clear focus that that my organization has.
Right.
We don't deal with the guys at the pipes level, and we don't deal with the guys at the content level in any way other than saying they're an important part of our overall ecosystem, and we need to make sure that as we deal with things in the middle, in the guys that rack and stack servers in the data center, above the pipe level and below the content level, that we can maintain a competitive environment here.
Sure.
So the fact is that most of our work with the FCC has been trying to explain to the FCC that the pipes level is different than the infrastructure level above it. That the layers are different and that there's a different competitive environment. The servers in the data centers and the web hosting companies and cloud infrastructure companies that sit above it, they are generally under FTC mandate.
Right.
And our goal has been to continue to foster that environment. It's an environment in which we have mostly been able to maintain a competitive environment, and that's why we want to make sure that we stay there.
Right. So, and people could interpret that different ways. You know, mm-hmm. I could interpret that by saying, well, if the FTC environment, which is generally the FTC protects consumers from harm after the fact, they see if there's a real harm and they enforce it after the fact. They don't write bright line rules the way the FCC does. You know, someone might hear you say that and say, well, that sounds like a great regulatory environment. Why would you want any internet company under something other than that? But let me ask the question a different way. I'll accept your partial pass on net neutrality. Today, we talked about not passing stupid legislation about encryption, not passing stupid legislation about internet intermediary liability. That's a lot of basically avoiding mistakes.
Yeah.
Are there things that you want to see proactively from government that would benefit small businesses and the internet ecosystem as a whole, not just avoiding blunders?
Well, I think that we need to take more proactive steps to restore the faith in the cloud. That has come from realizing where we are on surveillance now. And I'm not just talking about Snowden. We can't keep beating the Snowden drum over and over again.
Oh, I'm happy to. But if you want to talk about something else, that's fine.
But, yeah, The fact is that it's not just surveillance either. It's also hacks. It's DDoS attacks. There are lots of things that have weakened people's resolve to move to the cloud. And there are proactive steps that we need to take in order to restore consumer confidence and actually create an environment in which there is more of a direct correlation towards like warrants and access to data.
Right. And we've talked about that on many episodes, and I'm guessing you're getting at a slew of proposals in Congress to reform the surveillance state, whether it's ECPA reform, requiring warrants to get access to emails and other stored communications, whether it's Section 702, that's foreign surveillance. For American tech companies, the European market is extremely important, and they are arguably much more concerned about what we do over here than we are as Americans concerned about our own government in some ways. And there are many things that need to get done if we are to reform the surveillance state. And there are many reasons to do it. It's not just about principles necessarily. It's not just about civil liberties. It's that businesses are being harmed by this because they're losing trust in their products and has nothing to do with something that they did. So it's really unfortunate when, sure, you could, you know, slam Google, Facebook, and AT&T for not sounding the alarm before Snowden. You know, sure, you can quibble with the fact that they were complicit up until the date of the revelations, but this is the world we live in now. These companies all have an incentive to foster trust in their products. And there's something that is being done at the government level that they really don't have much control over. They can fight back to the best of their ability, and that's harming their bottom line. And we never want to see a situation where government doing something to try to catch the 0.00 whatever percent of people in this world who are bad, harming 99% of businesses. That doesn't seem like a good trade-off to many people.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, are there any other issues that you wanted to hit on and in relation to small businesses and the internet before we wrap up?
There end up being a lot. But you know, the one thing that I will say is that because the internet touches us everywhere these days, a fundamental understanding of how the internet works is an important component of a legislative education, meaning that I think that this lens should be put through a lot of different pieces of legislation, not just specifically tech policy legislation. Yeah. So my organization is trying to drive forward the idea that we need to get up there more, talk to Congress, talk to legislators, regulators about how the industry works, with an idea of teaching them the whole ecosystem, sharing the information about the fact that it is still predominantly driven by these small to medium businesses who rack and stack servers and data centers that people don't know exist because they're in dark rooms in the middle of nowhere.
Right, basically wherever electricity is the cheapest. Right. Yeah. Which is not necessarily going to be in your like backyard at a major city, right?
Yeah, exactly. But they're drivers of the entire digital economy, which is now the entire economy. So it's necessary to have that fundamental education.
Yeah, and that's basically a direct contrast to, I think, the attitude that many in this space had for a while, which is that why should we even bother with government, right? And while maybe in a perfect world, government understands everything perfectly and they don't screw anything up with regulation, that's just not the world we live in. And I think most of these savvy companies are realizing this and realizing that as much as they can afford to, coming here, as unfortunate as it may be, hopefully not with your tail between your legs, hopefully with your head held high, go and explain to the FCC and Congress how things work, how not to screw things up, etc. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Christian Dawson, Executive Director of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition. That is the I2 Coalition for short. And we've been talking about small businesses building the internet. Christian, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think of this show. Let us know that you think I'm a bad host, that I need to be replaced. I'm sure Barron will appreciate that. Let us know what topics you want to hear and guests that you want to hear. Feel free to pitch yourself as a guest if you're involved in this space, as I'm sure many of you are. Find this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can leave us a review because it will help others find the show. And note, Barron, we did not talk about Ayanna, so you're welcome. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.